Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Today, the dreams of the dying. Research shows that the majority of dying patients experience vivid and comforting dreams and visions of their dead loved ones. No matter how physically isolated, the dying are not alone at the end of their lives. Joining us is Christopher Kerr. He's the Chief Medical Officer and Chief Executive Officer for Hospice and Palliative Care Buffalo. His work focuses on the human experience of illness, specifically patients' dreams and visions at the end of life, which published in the book Death is But a Dream: Finding Hope and Meaning at Life's End. Dr. Kerr, welcome. We're so excited to have you here this morning.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Also with us, psychiatrist Mark Whaley. Good morning.
Good morning.
And social worker Jenny Putnam. Hi, Jenny.
Hi.
We'd love to start with a little bit about your journey to hospice and how that changed your outlook as a physician.
I wish I could say it was intentional, but it was a series of random events. I had come to Buffalo to do a cardiology fellowship, and I needed to moonlight. And so I saw an ad in a newspaper for a hospice doctor. And I remember thinking how odd it is that somebody's advertising for a doctor in a want ad, but it was odder that I was the one responding to it. But anyways, I came here really unprepared, certainly not trained to treat the dying from my residency or med school. And it was just very eye-opening. And I wasn't here very long. And I realized this was the most meaningful work I had ever done as a physician. And particularly at that time, medicine was being squeezed in a way that it was hard to find the rewards in it at the bedside. And in this model of hospice, the expectation is your time's protected. So you can get to know your patients as people, be present, get to know their families. So going from the assembly line of an acute care role as a physician to this was just eye-opening, really heart-opening, and I've never looked back.
Was the death of your father, that experience, is that what inspired you into this research of the dreams and visions of the dying?
No, I'm sure the psychiatrist here will have something to say about this, but actually, I was probably the most death averse person because I lost a parent as a child, and ironically, you can be very comfortable in med school and in acute medicine and avoid and be death denying because it's kind of built around only the curative aspects of care, right? Mm-hmm. No, I had a strong aversion, and at the same time, and this is where the psychiatrist may want to chime in, you wonder, so I obviously saw my father at the end of his life have these kind of intense dream vision experiences, and then is it random that I ended up, of course, studying this? Mm-hmm. But I didn't seek it. I ended up doing the research because I was extraordinarily frustrated in trying to teach medical students and residents that there was the dying that we observed, and then there was the patient's experience of dying, and we had so little regard for the subjectivity of what was happening, and we were just so focused on the medicalization of it that that's how the research grew, because they would say to me, well, there's no evidence that the patient's having these experiences, so we went out to prove that it was true. Mm-hmm. So anyways.
Yeah. Mark, you want to add anything there?
No, he explained it clearly. The point is that he was open to the experience and searching, probably, if you really want to get into his psyche, whatever. I'm very glad and grateful that he did what he did. He had the typical medical school experience of learning all the technology and really kind of with the unsaid motto of getting power over death. Mm-hmm. And being kind of like a religious principle in medicine. And as a result, medicine has suffered and still does. And people will complain about how their relatives die in a hospital setting. So medicine has a lot to learn from this. Mm-hmm. But the really magical thing is the stories that has elicited or just been open to hear from these patients and how valuable that experience is. It's like no other experience of life. It's not. It also is not an experience of death. It's an experience of living, living intensely at this in the last moments or last chapters of one's life.
It's funny you say that, Mark, because I wrote this down. I watched an interview you did, and this is a quote. You said, "Because you are dying doesn't mean you stop living, and you do intense living in the latter period." So talk a little bit about that, Dr. These are not like the same dreams that we have normally of everyday life, right?
No,
I'm sorry. Do you mind if we sort of give an overview quickly of what kind of dreams we're talking about? Is that
yeah.
Sure.
So dying is this very different. You have a this different vantage point, and it makes sense that you become introspective and reflect on life. And obviously, you're not focused on trivial matters of taxes or bills or whatever. You're going to focus on what matters most. The other dying is also defined as progressive sleep, and sleep cycles and architecture changes, so you're in and out a lot. So it also makes sense that you're having these intense dream experiences within dying. What is fascinating, though, is our patients are very adamant that this isn't a dream. So it's not fantastical, it's not metaphorical. They're not looking for analytics or analysis or interpretation. These are typically feel as though virtual. When we ask them to measure the realism of it, it's 10 out of 10. So we use the word dreams because that's the closest nomenclature, but these feel like lived and actual events. They tend to focus on what matters most in life, which is our relationships, and they increase in frequency as people approach death. And the content tends to change as you get closer to dying. You're more and more likely to see people who you've loved and who you've lost. And these tend to be the people who secured you, who loved you unconditionally. It doesn't matter the distance from their loss. It could be 90 years, but they're there for you in a very tangible way. There's not a lot said between dreamer and dreamer, but the presence is there. They know intuitively what that means. They're overwhelmingly comfortable. They occur about 88 to 90% of people when we ask them every day. So we would do surveys every day, and many of these people are filmed, so you can actually see them talking. Very importantly, we ruled out confusion. So every day they were screened because the medical deflection of this, or defense, or interpretation is that this is just a confusional state. So these people had to be screened every day. So the frequency increases, and the greatest comfort when you look at what thematics they're looking at or content is seeing the deceased. So there's this trajectory where you're having more of these. You kind of have a foot in our world, but you're also having these intense inner experiences that are overwhelmingly comforting, that in the end tend to put you back together by those that formed, loved, and defined you. And as the doctor so perfectly put, these are absolutely life-affirming. Rather than they don't deny death, but they just more affirm life. And in doing so, almost the fear of death definitely declines. The question back to the original question of this notion that you don't stop living even though you're dying, it's absolutely true. And we actually did a very interesting study where we view dying as something called post-traumatic growth. The idea within a negative experience like dying, there can be positive gain. And what we showed was people who were having these had significant, statistically research-based, significant growth, adaptation, insight, spiritually, personhood, that they were learning and evolving right into the last days of life, which inverts what we think of dying, which we really define by what we see objectively in the physical dimension, which this physical lessening. But in fact, spiritually, psychologically, they're growing. So this isn't a passive process. So there's this paradox in dying then. There's what we see, and then there's what's actually the patient is experiencing.
We hear a lot about near-death experiences, but these dreams and visions that you've studied are not the same thing, right?
No, I really appreciate that question, because there's actually, I'm by no means an expert on near-death, but there's almost, I can't see any parallel qualitatively. So the from what I understand about near-death is, you know, there's some enlightenment, there's some great reveal, and people are almost structurally changed in a way they have to want to go back and live differently, think differently, interact differently. When you think about it, people are actually dying. There's a trajectory. It's not kind of a sudden event. They really are dying. Life is closing. And it would be cruel if you were given work to do that you couldn't do. I've never had a patient say to me in 25 years having these experiences, what do you think this means? This isn't an analytic thing. This isn't a door opening to something. And there aren't great epiphanies or great unfoldings. You don't need interpretation. If you lost your mother as a child and she's there for you, that is a knowing.
Yeah.
So these are things that tend to be felt rather than processed in deep cognitive ways. They're just they're experienced.
Right. Go ahead, Jenny.
You talked about that people have people who they felt unconditionally loved by with them. And I have throughout my career had a number of patients who never felt that from anyone, whether that's because their parents were pretty abusive and then they just kept going into more abusive relations after that, or other reasons. And so have you encountered that type of person, and do they still meet someone they knew, or do they meet some other figure or somebody else who sort of helps them?
Are you familiar with the famous Ferdinand School in Massachusetts?
No.
Oh, there's a book. It was a home that was actually supported by GE and other large scale companies. And it was Senator Ted Kennedy actually had a Senate investigation on this school, because it ended up becoming housed for all sorts of people with who are cognitively different, but also who had lost parents or who'd been troubled children. So they had a spectrum of children, and it was part of a eugenics philosophy kind of thing. It was very sad. There's a book about it, and Steven Spielberg actually has the movie rights. I had a woman here in Buffalo who grew up in that institution.
Was it the Fernald School?
Yes.
Yeah, that's what you're referring to. Fernald.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, very famous, right? And she was actually from exactly where you guys are. She ended up in there, so she never knew love at all and nurturing, and she would even have trouble. She would describe seeing people kissing on TV.
Like, mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
Understand it. So that sort of person who just wasn't able, hadn't developed with a sense of being loved. And at her end of life, she had had a long series of relationships where she felt used by men. But one man came to her at the end of her life, and he had asked her to marry him at some point, and she said, oh, no. And actually, she kicked him out of her house. He had passed away. He comes to her at the end of her life and says, you know, I really did love you. And that was really the first experience that she held tangible, proximal love that she felt. And it was alarming to her. These experiences don't deny the life you led, right? So you die as you live. And I think actually one of the things we got most wrong is we asked people to click off whether these were positive or negative, comforting, discomforting, what have you. And what we made an assumption that the negative was without value. And in fact, some of the most, what we would consider negative or discomforting end of life experiences were some of the most transformational. There were healing that occurred in the last days and weeks of life that had not occurred in previous decades. despite pharmaceuticals, therapy, all sorts of course corrections. You know, the veteran who had survivor's guilt from World War II, who his comrades come to him and say, "We're coming for you now." And for the first time, he feels release of survivor's guilt. A lot of these people are on film, and they're absolutely fascinating. When we've all been harmed for having lived. And a lot of these emotional wounds, they're just, they're central to who we are. And those often get addressed. And sometimes it's fascinating how they're carried. You know, we had a fella who was born in poverty to a blue collar family who lost his arm at the age of 8. And he had no idea, he couldn't describe the fear of how he was going to function, get changed, be independent, earn a living, have worth. And at the end of his life, he sees himself lying on a bed, and all of his coworkers he ever knows comes by and tells him he was the best worker they ever knew. Mm-hmm. So whatever that lesion is, it seems to be addressed.
Yeah. There was one. You had a lot of vivid examples in your book, which is very well written, by the way. I would urge people to look at it. You might want to have a box of Kleenex nearby. Actually, it is very moving. I was wondering if you could tell us about the woman who was cuddling her infant baby, Daniel.
Yes.
Yeah. That. It's funny you ask, but that was actually pivotal for me, because that's when I stopped worrying about trying to understand this and just learn, have reverence for it. As a physician, it was a role reversal. Instead of doing things to people, it was a case where you learned, you know, just being there and present had value, right? What had happened was I hadn't been in hospice very long. And the woman's name was Mary, and she had 4 living children. And her children were wonderful. They were kind of having this camping out in the room. And she, at the end of her life, was reflective and relaying openly. She was an artist and very expressive and saying all these things that she was experiencing. They all made sense. She was seeing her grandparents, her childhood dog. And then out of the blue, she starts cradling a baby that nobody can see, obviously. And she's cooing the baby and kissing the baby. And she's referring to the baby by name, which was Danny. And that kind of, I was there, and the children had no idea what the reference, and just thought this was a confusional state of some sort, that it didn't fit into any personal history they knew of. And then what happened was her sister flew in from Minnesota, and she was standing in the doorway, and they were telling her that she's referring to this baby named Danny. And she just kind of stood there stunned. And she said, well, Danny was her first child she had lost at birth, stillbirth. And obviously it was one of those wounds that she carried and could never give language to. It just was in that spot and it hurt too much. But there she was at the end of her life, reconnected to this child and surrounded in love.
We're talking about the dreams and visions of the dying and what we can learn from that. 866-999-4626 is our number. If you'd like to join our conversation, that's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking about dreams and visions of the dying and what we can learn from that. With us is Christopher Kerr. He's a chief medical officer and chief executive officer for Hospice and Palliative Care Buffalo, and author of Death is But a Dream, Finding Hope and Meaning at Life's End. Also with us, psychiatrist Mark Whaley and social worker Jenny Putnam. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We've got an email from from Lynn, who says, could you speak to this when it comes to people with dementia or Alzheimer's? On different occasions, different loved ones at the end of their lives, both dealing with advanced memory loss, both nonverbal, seem to have moments of complete clarity in which they had full, intelligible conversations with loved ones that had passed years earlier. They were sleepy or sleeping and then came awake when this happened, and they didn't interact with anyone else in the room, only these dead family members. It brought comfort to the family, but I wonder if there's been any research into this.
It's well known within medicine. It's referred to as terminal lucidity, where somebody who may have significant cognitive decline has memories rekindled. And you know, most of us understand this about people with dementia is they have they're not able to form new memories, but they have intact distant memories. So they may not know what they had for breakfast, but they remember what they wore to their high school prom. So the mistake is thinking of cognition as a monolith, and there's obviously different compartments. So you know this with music. Music will rekindle memory in deep, vivid detail. So something, and I think it's a sad, medically refer to these people in their terms of their deficits, not recognizing that they have rich emotional histories and feelings, and they're rekindled at the end. And I think that this process in dying often does that. So it's not uncommon to see somebody who pops up and all of a sudden can remember their child's name, and they might not have remembered it for the last year. They do this in very colorful and rich ways. We had a woman, and she's on film with her daughter, where as she got closer to death, she was much more immersed in the love and memory of her relationship with her deceased husband, to the point that she's trying to get out of the nursing home because she has to get to her wedding. So when you would expect escalating psychogenic distress to death, she's actually more anchored in a past that is emotionally rich and meaningful to her. So yeah, it's very common. I think they almost do it in a better way because they're less bound to the reality we may share with them and much more in another place.
Yeah.
And that can be kindled by photographs, for example, old photographs and music.
What about the experience with children who are in hospice care and dying? Is the experience different for children than adults?
Yes, it's different in a lot of ways, in ways that are absolutely stunning. They obviously, children don't have necessarily a sense of mortality, of finality. They live much more in the moment. So how do they understand that aspect? And probably more significantly, they may not have known someone who has died. We have one of the nation's largest pediatric palliative care programs here in Buffalo. So we see a lot of this. And what we're struck by is how these internal events often become very informing for them. So they do have a sense of what is happening to them. And where they may not know a person, an animal often appears. And they may not be their pet. It could be a neighbor's, a grandparent's. And some of these children are actually on film, they're online. And what's fascinating is the animal, they don't distinguish, obviously, children do, between the animal world and the human world, right? So the animals give them a message that's the same in that they're told, and this is their words, that they're loved and that they're not alone. So they'll create this existence with their eyes closed where they see, and the animal's seen in health. But they know the significance of it, which is really fascinating. You know, and some of the children do remarkable things. So we have we had a young lady who created a castle for herself where all the 13 animals she knew who had passed were all in there. And when asked what the castle meant, she said it meant it was a safe place. Mm-hmm. So there's some kind of formation in the dying process for children that allows them to process this psychologically and give them a sense of comfort and solace.
Since I was telling you before we went on the air, I had an uncle who lived with us who was 99 and he was in hospice. And after looking at your work, it made so much sense to me. And people are asking meaning, right? The person who's dying gets the meaning. It's a feeling they know. But he had said at one point, "Oh, the cat came up and slept in my bed with me last night. We don't have a cat." And I was looking around going, "Did some wild animal get in the house?" And then was, "Do you have workers in the house? Who was the man who brought me the blanket?" There was no man who brought him a blanket, but it meant something to him, right? So this is just so fascinating to me. And I'm wondering, does this, is it the same across different cultures as well?
Oh yeah, it's that's actually where all the evidence is. Our I should clarify. We discovered absolutely nothing, zero. All we did was put it in a medicalized context for a Western culture. This is a rich tradition in other parts of the world and within Indigenous people. It's a way they connect to their ancestral past. They view dying completely different. In fact, a two-time award-winning filmmaker from Australia is doing a film right now. It's just being edited. We're involved in it. And she went to the Indigenous in the outback of Australia in the Amazon. And she coupled their belief systems with our research to bring the truth. So when people say there isn't evidence for this, there may not be scientific, kind of more medicalized evidence, but there's an abundance of evidence in the humanities. It's very much vibrant within those cultures.
You know, it's interesting to me also sort of the flip side of that, the survivors of people who have died and how the relationship that we, the living, can have with people who have died. So over and over again, what I've seen in my office is people who, after a loved one who they had a problematic relationship with dies, they heal that relationship, whether that's suddenly seeing the good parts of the relationship that they hadn't been able to see before because they were so caught up in the bad, or in fact, actually seeing and working through the bad parts and being able to do that now that they don't have the connection to the living person. And so one of the things I'm sort of wondering about, and maybe you know this, a story like this, is if ever, you know, if you had a really bad relationship with your mom and then she comes to you as you're dying, but in a more loving way, is that ever something you see?
Yes, but more commonly, I hate to be crude about it, we see them excluded.
That's fine.
So I mean, and I have a great case of that in the book where there was a woman who had a very cold mother who was demanding and withheld love and affection, and a father who was full of life, demonstrative. And, you know, and their thing, by the way, was really interesting. She had two lives, one in the home, but then she'd run out every day at a certain time, meet her father in a clearing. He was a mailman, and they'd go hand in hand and do the route. And so at the end of her life, she starts talking about the various neighbors she's seen because she's doing the mail route with them. But at no point did she see the mother. So we'll often see one sibling, but not another, one parent, not another. We had somebody who had three husbands, actually loved the second. That's the one who appeared. So it's this form of kind of final justice. And it's love in its truest, best form.
There's so many people who fear death, right? A lot of us who fear. And you talked a little about this comforting, these visions and dreams being very comforting. And the people, the patients that you've worked with, what do you find? Are all of them at the end not so fearful, or is it just a certain percentage? I mean, what happens to that fear?
That's where this needs to go, because the longer I do this, and if you watch, we have all, you know, so many of these patients are on video. The thing that's most impressive is the absence of fear. It's it's and actually there's a lot of people who go back and forth in these positions who actually prefer their existence with their eyes closed and what their experience, particularly if they've, you know, they've lost a spouse they were married to for 60 years. You know, from where we sit, the thought of death can raise your heart rate. I mean, it's central to our ability to survive. What happens in illness is exhausting. It's tiring. It feels better not to do, not to talk, to sleep more. There becomes this altered state. And there does become some kind of, I don't like the word acceptance, but a transition where they are certainly more at peace. Are there exceptions? Absolutely. The exceptions generally are people who have unfinished lives, people with children, young children, for example, who do rage against the dying of the light. But those words, Dylan Thomas's words, actually describe very few of our patients. When he was writing that, he was doing it from a perspective of health, imagining dying. The dying don't talk like that. They're okay. And what's beautiful is hope transitions. They're no longer hopeful for cure, but they really hope for others. And that's what you hear from. There's a much better story in the dying process that is selfless and giving. We found that even in our work, because when we first tried to do this work, we were denied because, you know, we're supposed to sterilize the dying and don't intrude. And in fact, without exception, everybody asked to participate has participated. Yeah. And many of them are okay being filmed, looking, you know, not much like themselves. So there's some selflessness that occurs.
Yeah, it's as if there's a ceasing of a censor that people have to create an impression and to develop, say the right things, you know, in order to be accepted in the moment. When you're dying, you don't need that anymore. It's just not useful. I look at it too as a process of evolution, really, that our brains have evolved over 4 billion years of life on the planet to predict all the time what's going to happen and guide your decisions cognitively, the conscious part of it, according to what the prediction is based on past experience primarily. At the end of life here that you're talking about, there's no need to get it right. There isn't anymore. And this is how we perceive things, actually. There's a process of predicting what's out there in the environment and then feedback and correction about what your prediction is according to what the senses feed back. The information they feed back. You don't need that anymore. Some of the things that you've described would be the best outcome for a psychotherapy session. Where there's an absence of the censor.
There's a release.
Release.
I heard a great term. It's unbinding.
Yeah.
So we're unbound from whatever. I mean, illness in any form tends to do that, right? Mm-hmm. It takes away pretense, for example.
Right, right.
The trivial drift aside. We get to more to our truer self. What truly matter rises to the surface.
Yeah.
And at end of life, we focus on really the greatest accomplishments, which are relationships.
Yeah.
And the thematics are truthfully love and forgiveness.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so yeah, it is remarkable. That's a good way to put it.
Yeah. We're talking about the dreams and visions of the dying this morning. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll have more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're discussing the dreams and visions of the dying this morning with Dr. Christopher Kerr. He's the Chief Medical Officer and Chief Executive Officer for Hospice and Palliative Care Buffalo and author of Death is But a Dream, Finding Hope and Meaning at Life's End. Also with us is psychiatrist Mark Whaley and social worker Jenny Putnam. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to join our conversation. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the impact on the families. We talk about these dreams and visions and how the patient just intuitively knows what it means, but I can see families going, what does that mean? What is the impact on families that go through this with their loved ones?
I mean, people don't die alone. They die in the context of those they love. And we've published two studies on the effect of this on the bereaved. And the best way to sum it up is that what's good for the patient is good for the family. We've actually done formal things, look at bereavement processing scales, and we can show that people bereave and remember in ways that are healthy for having witnessed these experiences. Again, it can invert dying from something that is empty and has finality and grim physically, or it can be seen as something that is life-affirming and love fulfilled. So you take that case of Mary, for example, and the child. Well, oftentimes that's a couple. And instead of looking at your life partner in the bed and seeing emptiness and drifting, and instead that person is seeing the child that you share together, that absolutely inverts the equation. And we have lovely videos of how people leave us matters. It informs us going forward as we process and recall. And people speak beautifully. I actually think there's videos of family that are as moving, if not more moving, than just of the patient alone. So it matters enormously. And to your point, which is how is that explained to the family, matters greatly, which is one of the concerns, because in a medicalized sense, if this is dismissed, ignored, it's obviously dehumanizing, but it's also very isolating. And one of our jobs is to, you know, get people closer to the bedside, not farther. And if this isn't normalized or explained or given permission, people won't interpret it for what it is.
Yeah.
Which is unfortunate.
Yeah. I was just thinking, you know, now my mother died suddenly. I don't remember a lot of that, you know, when that happened, because you're still processing everything. My father, on the other hand, had pancreatic cancer and died in hospice. Completely different experience. I remember everything of that. And that relationship, and the more you learn, I mean, I learned things about my father I did not know. I did not have that opportunity with my mother. So in a lot of ways, I always think these hospice people are just, they're amazing. Every hospice person I've ever come across, such amazing people. They teach us a lot. And the same thing about the whole dying process. You know, how would we know? And they can tell things that we can't tell, and they share those experiences. It's just, I mean, the work that you do is just amazing. Mark?
This speaks to me very, very strongly in terms of my path in medicine. I originally went to medical school thinking about psychiatry as the goal, and had some experience in it working in hospitals. But toward the end, I got enthralled with oncology. I was in medical school at the time of Cooper Ross, and they first started to pay attention to death and dying. I took a rotation in oncology and was fairly quickly turned off, because the role of the doctor there was to be like a scorekeeper and to predict what chemotherapy medication would work based on what study had just been published, what the percentages were. It was math in a way. That was too, it hadn't been humanized, I guess is the point. Psychiatry, on the other hand, is kind of nothing but humanized in a way, and even that is questionable.
I respect your choice.
It's a way of connecting and being very intimate with others without you know, with their permission, obviously, but it's like nothing else, I think. And so that's why I related so strongly to hearing about your work and,
thank you.
Watching the interviews and that kind of thing. So please keep it up.
One of the things that I really loved about the stories that I heard, I didn't read your book, I will, but the ones that I did hear was that it allows, and it sounds like what you do, it allows the families to make whatever meaning out of it they need to. And so as you were talking about like belief systems in other cultures, I had read a book called Good Dying, something like that.
Dying Well.
Dying Well, talking about the Chinese ritual of having a shrine to family members who have died and how they have a much healthier relationship to death and dying because of that. And I mean, obviously not all of them because there's no universal thing, but I really like that, that it sort of feels like this experience that can be universally appreciated, which is a rare, and maybe it's because it's a universal experience, dying, but it felt very much like this sort of, regardless of your belief system, it would be reassuring to both have that and to see a loved one.
Mm-hmm. It's a healthier version. You know, I mean, it's, if you think back to our grandparents, right? They probably died in their home. Or their great grandparents died in their home. People mourned collectively, maybe in your home. Death was palpable. It was recognized. It was processed in a healthier way. Children grew up seeing death as a part of life. And then somewhere over the ensuing decades, it became institutionalized. You know, with the vast majority of people dying in things like ICUs, most are going to an ER in the last couple of months of life. So it sterilized, it dehumanized it. It drew us further from it as a human experience. And there's a lot of unhealth in that.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
What about religion? Religion has taken a big piece of the real estate of the dying process, but not so much in what you address, what you found in the research.
Yeah, so we struggled with this enormously when we first started to get the results. I mean, we had thousands of respondents, right? And the absence of religious reference was jumped out. And other people have found the same thing in other cultures. And then my mentor and colleague, Robert Milch, says to me, because I'm trying to write this in a paper in a way that wasn't hurtful. And he says, you're missing. He goes, it's absolutely consistent with the tenets of faith of all. What is it? Love and forgiveness.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And then there was a beautiful piece written by Reverend Carrie Egan, who is a Harvard Divinity trained woman who wrote a piece that ended up on the wire called How People Die. And she has a book. I really recommend it. And she recalls arguing with her professor that, because she was caring for the dying, that they're not talking about Jesus in church, etc. Because that's not how they learn God's love. It's the first and last classroom of love is our families.
Right. First church.
They don't think in theologic terms, right? They go back to love in its origin, unconditional love and forgiveness, which is what we do with those we love. And it starts with our family, with the families we make or the families that we adopt. And so that was the argument, but she says it in a much more articulate way. But that actually that honors what we're seeing best. Is that the translation, arguably, of an intended, spiritual love.
Yeah. How has your work been received by the medical community so far?
Well, it's a funny story. So I mentioned that we did this work to give evidence for the skeptical physician. And that's also why we film people, because we, and that ended up being in documentaries, because we thought, well, they're going to think they're feeble-minded or drugged or whatever. And we heard absolutely nothing when we started publishing. Zero. But this is fascinating. What ended up happening was I ended up giving a TED talk that now has over 5 million views. And it's just kind of gone around the world. It was just recently in the New York Times again last month or whatever. It never stops. And it, literally around the globe. And what's fascinating is that the contrast between the medical community that has no interest in it, and yet the recipients of care, all of us on the other side, and you can understand why people don't want the doctor's death.
Yeah.
They don't want that version of end of life. So I think it gives me hope, because people are truly value anything that humanizes the dying process. So that's where the answer. So my point is, I was holding the wrong end of the stick. I meant this for a medical audience, and never thought that anyone else would give a darn. In fact, I didn't publish it for 10 years because I never thought anyone would care.
Wow.
I missed the boat entirely.
So just kind of going back to like the purpose of these dreams and visions, it doesn't really matter, right? I mean, it's like you say, it's sort of putting back together. I like the way you describe it, journey of discovery, right? And it's not only just a journey of discovery for the person who's dying, but for those around them, right?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, you mentioned this, is that what you end up appreciating as you stand distant from it is there's this, lives aren't lived in segments. There's this interconnectivity between all these lives, living or dead. So that the child may be hearing her grandmother talk about her parent. And there's this weave that goes through the different generations that's absolutely fascinating. That it binds them in a way.
My very, very close friend Anne died of Huntington's 2 years ago. And well, not 2 years ago, whenever the height of the pandemic was, and I could not be there with her as she died. And I have been so upset about that ever since then. She had a brother, a mother, both of whom had Huntington's and who had predeceased her, and her father predeceased her. And once I heard about your work, I thought, oh, maybe she wasn't alone. Maybe she had them with her. Right. And furthermore, I'm hoping that whenever I go, she'll come, you know, I will see her.
I wrote a piece about this during COVID, because it was so horrible to see people removed. Yeah. And my argument basically is they may have been isolated from us, but we don't see people die alone. There many people are less alone at the end of life than they have been in the preceding years, because what they're experiencing is, you know, there's actually a book, you know, all the people in the room or something like that at the end of life, because that is the reality, is what their experiences for, you know, you've even recounted some of your own experiences that it was an actual event for these people. The cat was on the bed.
Yes. Right.
And you couldn't convince your grandfather that that wasn't the case.
Yes.
And that's the same true of the people. Yeah.
Comforting to know that nobody's dying alone. That's good. Christopher Gross, Chief Medical Officer and Chief Executive Officer for Hospice and Palliative Care Buffalo, author of Death is But a Dream, Finding Hope and Meaning at Life's End, psychiatrist Mark Whaley, social worker Jenny Putnam. Thank you so much. Dr. Kerr, thanks for being with us. This was a fascinating hour. Really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. Great conversation.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.